saw you and friends, I got a good vibration. You could very well be my virtue vice for mom. I'm a man with much loving and good material. I know all you need is a lion with strong vibration.
The rapture was, the rapture sauce.
I think you will have to do the true nature.
It's what's in your heart, that's where it starts.
That's who she picked up as it just the rapture
sauce. The rapture was, the rapture sauce.
As you similar to you, the true nature.
It's what's in your heart, that's where it starts.
That's who she feels the best, it's just the last she wants. Tap tapping on my shoulder, she said, Lucci, come over. You are the side to be old. With that smile, you want me over. Could you just kindly come closer?
I can share some roots with my future. I'll be right she wants.
This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, Healthful Living's radio show. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and today we have a great show. I'm so excited to introduce Devin Houston, who is the president of Houston Nutraceuticals and Enzyme Company. So I would love to get started right away. Let me see if I can get him on the line. Devin, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. So we are live on the air, and I just wanted to introduce you to our guests out there so they can know a little bit about you, and then we can go into the exciting world of enzymes. So you have a PhD in biochemistry, and you have been researching enzymes since the early 80s,
right.
And you have your own company called Houston Nutraceuticals, correct?
That's correct.
And so maybe we should start at the beginning here. So what are enzymes?
That's always the first question. Enzymes are basically proteins, but they're specialized proteins because they have what we call a catalytic activity in that they are able to accelerate chemical reactions or even cause some reactions to occur that otherwise would not occur at conditions conducive to life. So these are very powerful proteins, and they do a lot of things in our bodies that otherwise could not be done. So basically, they're proteins that are essential to life.
And what are some examples of some other industries and things that use enzymes to give people an example?
That's interesting because we tend to think of enzymes as something that help with digestion, but actually Americans and most people in the world use enzymes in other aspects of their life. If you wear a contact lens, you probably use a type of cleaner that uses a proteolytic enzyme to remove the protein deposits within the contact lens. Laundry detergents contain enzymes as stain busters. There are enzymes in meat tenderizers, for example. And in the food industry, there are enzymes that do all sorts of things. For example, the difference between homemade bread and bread you buy in a supermarket. The soft top on the supermarket bread is caused by adding a amylase enzyme to the dough while it is rising, and that breaks down the gluten and the wheat carbohydrates that are in the dough, and when it bakes, it doesn't harden up. It produces a softer top. So enzymes are used in a variety of things. They make the juice industry, the wine industry, a very large number of different types of industry use enzymes.
Now, in my world of autism and biochemistry in general, we hear a lot about all different types of enzymes. You know, there's the PST enzyme. There's a variety of different enzymes that we use inside our body, and so I'm curious, what's the difference between a metabolic enzyme like that and then a digestive enzyme? And these examples you were giving, were these digestive enzymes or were these metabolic enzymes?
Well, they were a little bit of both, but that's an important distinction. Metabolic enzymes basically are enzymes that work inside cells where they do a number of things. For example, people who have PKU or phenylketonuria are missing a particular enzyme that transforms the amino acid phenylalanine, and if that enzyme is missing, these people cannot eat foods that have phenylalanine with them. That is due to an enzyme that's found within a certain cell, and it's very difficult to, for example, you can't take that enzyme orally and be cured of PKU disease. Basically, that enzyme would have to get to the correct organ and get into the cell, which is very hard for a protein to cross into a cell. So a metabolic enzyme is an enzyme that is usually made within the cell that it's going to do the work. Now, the other category of enzymes that we're going to be talking about is the digestive enzyme category. And these are the enzymes that break down the proteins, the carbs, and the fats in our foods, so our body can utilize those for all the different purposes that we eat for.
And these are released in the digestive system, correct?
Correct. Our pancreas produces the majority of these enzymes, and there are a few enzymes in the stomach itself, and there are many other enzymes within the GI tract. And all of these, any organ that's involved in the digestion of food is going to have some type of enzyme there to facilitate the breakdown of the food we eat.
Can you just give a couple names of those for people that might have heard or might be looking at their own bottle of enzymes right now to get an idea of what you're speaking of?
Sure. We can even start from the first process of eating. For example, when you chew a cracker or a piece of bread, and your mother always told you to chew your food, and that's very important. Your mom was a biochemist and didn't realize it. But there is an enzyme in saliva called amylase, and it's similar to the enzyme I mentioned earlier. If you take a cracker and hold it in your mouth, the amylase in the saliva will start converting the starch into sugar. So that's why you start sensing that sweet sensation when you chew bread or a cracker for any length of time. So basically, digestion is going to start as soon as you start chewing your food. You get the amylase and it starts breaking down the starch. You then swallow the food and it enters the stomach, and there is the major protease involved in digestion, or probably the most important one, is a proteolytic enzyme called pepsin. And it's activated by the acid in your stomach, and it starts the breakdown of many different kinds of proteins. Pepsin is also important because it acts as a trigger for the protease enzymes and other enzymes found in the pancreas later on downstream as the food moves out of the stomach into the duodenum of the small intestine. And there's the pancreas shoots out a whole bunch of different enzymes, elastase, chymotrypsin, trypsin, lipase, different types of carbohydrates, and all designed to start the work of breaking down the food so that we can turn proteins into peptides and amino acids, carbohydrates into simple sugars, and triglyceride fats into short-chain fatty acids. And that's how we assimilate the food, and that's how our body derives energy from food, is from those byproducts of the enzymes that we have in our stomach and GI tract.
So what happens when somebody doesn't have these enzymes functioning optimally?
Okay, well, one that that a lot of people can identify with, and it affects me and just about anybody over the age of 35 or 40, is lactose intolerance. And that's due to a deficiency of the enzyme lactase. When we're born, we have high amounts of this enzyme. And this is the enzyme that breaks down the milk sugar, lactose, into two simple sugars. I believe it's glucose and fructose. And those two simple sugars are what the body, especially young infants and babies, need to have their brains grow and to feed their muscles and that type of thing. Now, as we get older, our body is sort of programmed, and we also stop drinking milk or dairy products, and so the body senses that we don't have as much lactose to work with, so it starts decreasing the amount of lactase enzyme. Usually around age 6 or 7 or 8, there's a tremendous decrease in that amount of enzyme. Later on in life, you'll start noticing when you eat the cheese pizza or have that bowl of ice cream that you'll start getting the cramping, the diarrhea, gas production, that type of thing that those of us who have lactose intolerance experience. Now, luckily, lactase is one of the enzymes that you can supplement orally and alleviate those symptoms. And actually, there's a many products containing the lactase enzyme out there on the market, and it provides a great deal of relief. So we can eat all the ice cream we want without worrying about the problem.
Right. Now, did I hear one time that probiotics, good bacteria, and that your gut can produce some of that lactase? Do you know?
Sure. In fact, that's why we have the friendly bacteria or the probiotics in our gut. It's not so much what the bacteria per se are there for, but it's what they produce. The bacteria produce enzymes. And, for example, one of the most popular probiotic organisms we take is Lactobacillus acidophilus, and it produces a lot of the lactase enzyme, as well as many other enzymes that help in breaking down food. So the bacteria produces enzymes that then break down the food that the bacteria can use, but also it's a beneficial relationship for both of us and the bacteria. They produce enzymes that help break down food that nourish us, and it also nourishes the bacteria. So taking an oral enzyme sort of bypasses the probiotic question, and certainly they do work together, and it's optimal to have both good probiotic flora in the gut as well as an optimal enzyme supply as well.
One of the arguments that some nutrition people put out, I don't necessarily agree, but is that we're supposed to drink milk as babies, but we're not supposed to drink milk when we get older, and so that's why we don't have the lactase enzyme. And so should we just not be drinking milk, or is it that the good probiotics and the good things that we're supposed to continue to have to help us break down those foods sometimes get, a little imbalanced over time, and so as we get older in life, we start to see these imbalances? So is it we're not supposed to have these foods, or is it that our body just isn't functioning as efficiently as it should?
Not necessarily. Lactase is what we call an inducible enzyme. It sort of responds to its production is responsive to the presence of lactose. So if one suddenly stopped taking any kind of dairy product, then the body would send, or the enzyme-producing cells, the lactase-producing cells, would sense that and decrease the production of the DNA that produces the protein enzyme. If one were to kept a steady supply of dairy products in their diet continually throughout life, then there would be some drop-off, naturally just because we eat other foods besides milk, not when we were babies and that was our sole source of nutrition. But it wouldn't be as dramatic. And there are other enzymes that are not inducible that will always be produced, so it doesn't matter. But just because our body is somewhat programmed in a way that it assumes that we are not going to be only eating milk for our life, that we will be meat eaters and vegetable eaters and such. So it tries to shunt some of the energy for producing lactase into other areas to sort of help the body conserve its resources in that manner. But that doesn't necessarily mean we have to change our diet, especially with all the good things that we're seeing about dairy peptides. And I don't want to be an advertisement for the dairy industry, but there do seem to be some very beneficial peptides and compounds in dairy products, and we're talking about good whole milk, not the over pasteurized, over homogenized 2%, 1% stuff that we see in the market.
Mm-hmm.
So, a great deal of the research that crosses my desk points to the fact that one can make a case that dairy is something we should keep in our diet. Now, you probably make the opposite argument for wheat and gluten. I don't see as I see more problems with wheat and gluten than I do dairy. So one may have a good argument for not including wheat products, and especially there's a good book called Going Against the Grain by Melissa Diane Smith. Makes good arguments for those with allergies and sensitivities to wheat to maybe exclude that from their diet. But certainly as children, dairy and wheat products are two critical sources of nutrition in a child that's growing, that's developing neurologically and physiologically. So you have to use common sense, I'm very hesitant to recommend putting children on very restrictive diets. The same may not apply to adults.
Mm-hmm.
Adults could probably use more restrictive diets with the obesity problem we have in this country. But it's just a good common sense type area.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about children then. Your company, do you specialize in children? Or I know that I obviously know of your company through autism and all the work I do with those kids. But does your company have a particular focus?
Well, they seem to have sort of gravitated toward us. Enzymes are something that anybody could benefit from digestively. What causes a lot of families dealing with autism and other spectrum disorders to seek us out is the fact that we provide an alternative to these restrictive diets by providing enzyme products that will break down dairy and wheat proteins. Instead of having to exclude them from the diet, then you can we can just use the enzymes to break down those proteins and not produce the particular peptides that seem to be bothersome to these children. And it not only works in children, but it works in adults who have these intolerances to wheat and dairy as well. And there seems to be other areas in which the enzymes seem to apply as well. A number of people seem to have immunological problems associated with dairy proteins and wheat proteins. And if it's an axiom in biochemistry, if you make a protein smaller, it sort of goes under the radar of the immune system surveillance mechanism. So that's what proteolytic enzymes do, is they chew up a protein into smaller pieces, and therefore it becomes something less attractive to the immune system as far as activating it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I can step back a second and explain a little bit to some people listening kind of what this process that goes awry in some of these kids are, and then how these enzymes might be helpful. So firstly, wheat and dairy tend to be two of the biggest offenders for a lot of these kids on the spectrum. And so the spectrum might include everything from autism to high-functioning autism to ADHD and a variety of imbalances in between. And what typically I see is that for some reason you have some inflammation in the gut, or you have decreased enzyme activity, and then you have these long protein chains that can't be broken down. And when they are broken down, these little amino acids go into the bloodstream and supply us with all the important things we need. But when that doesn't happen, inflammation is created and something called leaky gut happens. And then these long protein chains get into the bloodstream, and this is where you get the problem. This is where they end up with gut inflammation, diarrhea, constipation. They might have aches and pains. It also will activate, like you said, an immune system response in some of them, and they can have endorphin responses, or they can create opiates out of these things. So you can imagine the imbalance that you can get in brain chemistry simply from having these foods not fully broken down properly. Do you know, or do you have a hypothesis of where this might start for them? Does this start with an enzyme deficiency? Does this start with an autoimmune condition? Does it depend on the individual person?
At one time, it was thought the simplest answer was that it was an enzyme deficiency. I think now what we're seeing, it's not really an enzyme deficiency, it's basically these kids are responding differently to something that happens or is supposed to happen normally. When we, you and I, eat wheat or dairy products, it's very natural for the proteases that are within our digestive tract to actually work in such a way that they produce these opiate-like peptides, namely casomorphin and glutamorphin. And in myself and in you, they're not going to cause much of a problem. It may be why drinking a glass of warm milk in the evening makes one sleepy. You're producing this casomorphin opiate-like peptide, and you're just, you know, get that warm, fuzzy, sleepy feeling. But these kids seem to react differently to the presence of these type of peptides. So, and we don't really know why. My hypothesis is sort of slanted to my previous research background in something called signal transduction mechanisms, where G protein coupled receptors, which the opiate receptor is one of those, is in that particular class of receptor. And it may be something linked to what we call a G protein. And again, that's a whole other area that is very complex and complicated. But I think there are some researchers that are beginning to show some interest in how signals are transduced in this population of people, and seeing if there's some difference that might explain the mechanism. So, you know, this is something that's really not abnormal. It's a normal part of digestion, but there's an abnormal response to the presence of these particular peptides. So a whole cottage industry has developed basically the GFCF diet, or the gluten-free, casein-free diet, to promote the abstinence of taking anything that may contain gluten or casein.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that in America, or especially in the United States, that is a very difficult thing to do because those two proteins are just they're just everywhere, especially if one eats out. Our we have a lot of processed foods that use these, and though labeling regulations are getting tougher, still many foods are not required to put that on the label as to whether they have or have been exposed or even been used on equipment that may have been processed previously with gluten or casein.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to be 100% compliant with the diet. My recommendation, or my working hypothesis, is rather than trying to avoid it, let's just break down. It's not the gluten and casein per se that's causing the problem. It's the breakdown products due to the interaction of two proteolytic enzymes in our system, the pepsin and the elastase. And there's a couple of neat papers that demonstrate how casein sequentially exposed to pepsin and then elastase will produce casomorphin peptide. So I take the approach, let's change the way that the gluten and casein is broken down from the starting point. And basically, let's start in the stomach, where commercially available enzymes are acid stable so that they can work in the stomach. And if we start breaking down by adding these different proteases to the stomach environment, we change the way that the casein and gluten molecule is broken down. And when you change the structure of a peptide or a breakdown product, you also change the function. That's another sort of dogmatic axiom in biochemistry, that structure denotes function. So change the structure, you change the function. In this case, you change the structure of the protein by breaking it down differently, such that you don't even produce the casomorphin or the glutamorphin peptide in the first place.
Hmm.
So by not having to worry about the casein and gluten and just addressing how they're broken down, you resolve a lot of the problems that these peptides seem to be causing.
So, boy, there's a lot in there that I have to figure out what to address first. So everybody makes casomorphins and gluteoglobulin morphines and those kinds of morphine substances, but just in much, much smaller amounts? Or do some people produce them in little amounts and these kids produce them in large amounts?
Well, it depends. If you consume a lot of dairy and a lot of casein, a lot of gluten, then more likely you're going to have more of these exorphin peptides than one who doesn't. So it's basically a matter of how much one consumes. The interesting fact is that the way that these peptides work is through an opiate receptor mechanism, and the more you consume, or the more peptide is around, actually the fewer number of receptors are around. It's a process called receptor downregulation. So you eliminate the receptors, and you need the receptors to facilitate what the peptide does. So it's a two-pronged process. You need the peptide and you need the receptor, and they need to interact together. So, interesting, that could be a whole different show on how signal transduction mechanisms work. But
Right. Basically,
yes, bottom line is yes, casomorphin and glutamorphin are present if you eat casein and gluten. Now, the problem is when you abstain from those foods or have very low levels, then the opposite happens with the receptor population. The opiate receptor population detects that there's not that peptide is not around, so it actually increases the number of receptors on the cells in the gut, cells in the brain, other places in the body, which means that if you do have a exposure to the casomorphin or the glutamorphin, any of these opiate peptides, then the chances of a peptide interacting with a receptor are much greater, just because you have more receptors around. So, you know, it makes sense to not worry about the gluten and casein and what may happen. Let's address it by breaking it down differently. The body doesn't care how the protein's broken down. It just wants the amino acids. Mm-hmm. It wants the end product. So all we're doing is adding different enzymes that break down proteins at different points in the amino acid backbone chain of that protein. These are naturally occurring enzymes. They're not something that the body would object to. It's the same enzymes that are found in things like pineapple and papaya. Though most of the enzymes available commercially are derived from a friendly fungal source called Aspergillus oryzae, Aspergillus niger. And these are enzymes that have been used for, about 100 years in the U.S. and for centuries in Asian countries with no problem at all. And this is the way that I think scientifically correct and just from a common sense standpoint, address the way the proteins are broken down instead of worrying about whether they're there or not.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely agree. It is very difficult because some people are so reactive to even tiny trace amounts of gluten and casein that it's very difficult to be 100% free of these substances. And I always recommend enzymes, even if somebody is doing a gluten and casein free diet. A question I have for you is, what I found in my practice is that while the enzymes definitely help, I haven't found this sort of free-for-all, eat all the gluten and casein you want and take the enzymes has had as positive a reaction for people. It's if they reduce it by 80% or as much as they can and then take the enzymes for that extra amount. What have you found? Have you found that it really doesn't matter and you can eat as much as you want of those substances?
I am one for moderation in all things. This is what we often see, or what some of the feedback we get from our customers is that these kids will initially actually be what we call cravers of dairy and wheat products. They just want to eat bread all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting enough, once you get them on a good enzyme product, the appropriate enzyme product, you will see this craving disappear. So, obviously, these kids are craving it for a reason, and they're basically just getting high off the opiate peptide or the exorphin peptide that's being produced.
Mm-hmm.
Once you add the enzymes to the diet, often there is this craving goes away, so there seems to be a natural reduction in the intake, and for good reason. They're not there's no reward mechanism in place. So why do something if you're not getting rewarded for it? So
sure.
That's why they tend not to do it. I think it might be wise for all of us to consider reducing wheat intake. But I would be the biggest hypocrite in the world to do that if you saw what I ate over the holidays.
It
was, rolls and breads and anything with a crust on it. I was over there digging out on it. So basically, this is my thinking is that families dealing with spectrum disorders have enough stress in their life that the added stress of wondering if a food is going to cause some bizarre reaction in your child or such, or the fact that you can't go out and have a nice meal outside the home, or take your kids over to grandma's and you have to worry about whether grandma's going to give them those gluten-laced cookies or not.
Right.
There's enough stress there already. I think if you can take a product that kind of, it's like, well, if he has it, this will take care of it and it won't be any problem. Then I think you're that much further ahead in the game.
Sure, sure. So for those of you who just joined us, you're listening to KPOO 89.5 FM. You're listening to Reality Sandwich with Julie Matthews and Devin Houston. Devin, so you take these enzymes at the beginning of a meal, correct?
Sure, yeah. That's and the only reason we state that, we don't want to add a bunch of rules to adding enzymes, but that just prolongs the contact time between the enzyme and the food. And I want to go back real quickly, I've had this thrown at me before. We're not advocating that you can take an enzyme and eat a junk food that will suddenly make it, healthy. Again, let's use common sense. We're not advocating going back to a diet of soda and potato chips. So,
right.
That's if enzymes could cause junk food to become healthy food, I would be the richest person in the world. So unfortunately, they don't do that.
Right.
But yes, taking enzymes prior to a meal basically lets the enzymes get there, get dissolved out of the capsule. And the nice thing about the oral enzymes is they're active once they get into solution. So they're there waiting for the food to come down, and they mix in the stomach, and they start working right away.
And these are different than animal-based enzymes, like the ones that might be derived from pig or something, where they are pancreas enzymes, correct?
Right. Pancreatic enzymes are available by prescription, and these are usually derived from pig or cow pancreas, and they are different from the plant-derived enzymes. They have a narrower pH range. They can't work in the stomach because of the acid environment. They can only work at neutral pH or slightly alkaline pH. So when a doctor prescribes pancreatic enzymes, the enzymes that they take are treated. They're enteric coated so that they are protected from the stomach acid. And then when they get into the intestinal tract or the alkaline environment of the intestinal tract, they will release. So, and here we're talking about trying to get the brunt of the enzyme work to be in the stomach, because very important message or point here is that peptides are not absorbed in the stomach. They are absorbed from the small intestine. So if one had casein or gluten in their stomach, then and you want to avoid the problems of the caseomorphin and the glutamorphin, you want the enzymes there to do the job there. And there are even enzymes. There's an enzyme called DPP4 present in certain plant enzymes that are specifically aimed at breaking down caseomorphin and glutamorphin. So if those peptides did happen to be there in the stomach, they're not going to be a problem until they get into the GI tract some 2 to 3 hours later. So that gives the enzymes that much time to come in contact with the offending peptide and break it down and turn it into something that is not caseomorphin or not glutamorphin, that won't interact with the gut receptors and cause a problem.
What do people do if their kids went over to somebody's house, they forgot their enzymes, or they were at school and they got into some cake and they didn't have their enzymes with them? can they take these enzymes a couple hours later or a few hours later? And what if it's, so two questions, if it's still in the digestive tract but it's a couple hours down the digestive tract, will they work? And then what happens if a lot of it's already entered the bloodstream? Can these enzymes help with that?
Well, yeah, the clock starts ticking. Like I said, that usually food stays in the stomach anywhere from a couple hours to 4 hours, depending on the type of food eaten, your metabolism and such. So you have that amount of time to get an enzyme in there to do the job. The other thing is, and this is sort of a common sense based on the physiology, since pepsin is one of the enzymes involved in the production of these peptides, and again, let's get a little technical. Pepsin is activated once the pH of the stomach is less than 5. So the more acid the stomach is, that's how pepsin is activated. A lot of parents have found that if you can raise the pH of the stomach, sodium bicarb or products that have the sodium bicarb in it, you're basically raising the pH above 5, and that inactivates pepsin. So since pepsin is one of the enzymes involved in producing these peptides, you're basically inactivating that enzyme, and so that can be one way to alleviate. The problem is the stomach wants, if there's food in the stomach is desperately trying to get the pH low,
mm-hmm.
So that the enzymes will be active. So it's kind of a temporary thing. But yeah, the clock is running. The best thing to do is try to get enzymes into the child as quickly as possible. Once a peptide gets into the bloodstream, if it is absorbed in from the gut and into the bloodstream, then there's really not a whole lot you can do. Enzymes, the vast majority of an oral digestive enzyme is going to stay in the GI tract. There is evidence that some small amount taken orally is absorbed in an inactive form, but you know, for an enzyme to work, it has to come into contact with the thing it works on, called the substrate. So,
mm-hmm.
Again, you're talking about circulation that goes very fast. And once the enzyme does get into the systemic circulation, there are other compounds in the blood that bind the enzyme and take it out of circulation. So, you're really on the clock. And there's things going against you if you can't get the enzyme into the stomach where the food is fairly quickly. So usually if you can get the enzyme in there 30 to 45 minutes after eating the offending food, then you got a good shot at breaking down those proteins.
Now, that's interesting, because I had heard that if you have inflammatory conditions, joint pains and things, people do proteolytic enzymes and other enzymes, that my understanding was that enzymes could go through the bloodstream and kind of eat up the inflammatory proteins, and I thought maybe that could also eat up the inflammatory...
Yeah, you're right. I don't mean to cut you off, but
okay.
This is something called systemic enzyme therapy. But again, you're hindered by the same constraints in that you need to take a high dose of the enzyme orally. And because only 2 to 5, maybe at most 10% of the enzyme you take orally is going to get absorbed. The process of the enzyme getting into the systemic circulation is through a process called pinocytosis in the gut. Basically, the wall of the gut envelops the enzyme molecule and engulfs it and then carries it through the GI wall into a capillary or into the bloodstream. And there are enzyme inhibitors in the blood called alpha-2 macroglobulin that bind the enzyme and basically inactivate it. There is some evidence, especially from the early 60s, there was a lot of research on the use of plant-derived enzymes as anti-inflammatory agents as well as analgesic agents, and some very, very good evidence that they do work that way. What killed that research was basically the abundance of drugs, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents that were produced shortly thereafter, which were much cheaper and had a higher profit margin. So naturally, the drug companies went to something that they could patent, and you know, you really couldn't patent an enzyme, a natural enzyme product. But yes, they do tend to have anti-inflammatory properties, especially proteolytic enzymes like bromelain and papain. A lot of if anyone can go to the medical literature online, use those keywords along with the word inflammation, and find those papers. And the problem is you have to take a lot of enzyme, and you have to take it fairly frequently to see some type of an effect.
Got it. So
it does seem to work through process of cytokine production and inflammatory mediators produced by neutrophils and those type of cells. It seems to interfere with the production of those inflammation-producing compounds.
Okay. Well, the answer on that, I suppose, is take them with your food if you can. in all cases, take them with your food, and if you can't, then do your best.
Do your best, and if there is some condition, the nice thing about the enzymes is that they're non-toxic. There's no upper limit on dosing. No one has OD'd on an oral enzyme product, and it's basically one of those things that you can try it and see what happens, and not having to worry about interfering with other supplements or other medications.
Great. So pregnant women and babies, and is there any limit or anything around that?
Well, there's two classes that we always are fearful of something happening.
Right.
But so we say common sense. So we have customers that use our enzymes with babies who are still nursing. Nursing moms use the enzymes basically to derive more nutrition from the food they eat, as well as to break down foods that may cause, you know, that may get into the milk and cause the baby some time of gastric distress. We do say if you are pregnant that maybe don't take high amounts of proteolytic enzymes, because they can have an effect on blood clotting times. They can, to use the term, thin the blood, as a lot of dietary supplements can. So if you're just using them for digestive purposes, that's fine, but avoid taking high doses later stages of pregnancy, or if you're facing a major surgical procedure.
Okay, but the standard digestive dose in general is typically fine.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
And, yeah, I know a lot of women in the later stages of pregnancy. They need a lot of digestive help. So
exactly,
that can help a lot with the heavy, bloated feeling, the gassiness, and that type of thing.
Sure. And then hopefully preventing any antibodies from being created that the baby might get exposed to. Do you know if that's true, that if you're creating antibodies, that those can, do we know if those can pass through to either the placenta or to the breast milk?
Well, I would have to dig back through my medical books to give you a really educated answer, but I believe it is that's one of the benefits of breastfeeding, is that the mom produces a lot of antibodies that are passed on into the milk, and that those can be very helpful for baby as far as protecting it from infection and while the baby's immune system is developing. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's a very critical period for nutrition, period. For mama and baby.
Sure. What about, can you become dependent on enzymes? I know for myself, I tend to have a little bit of weak digestion, and I find that, you know, with the more complex meals like dinner and things, I like to take enzymes, and I've been taking, it's reduced greatly. You know, I used to take enzymes all the time with all meals, and now it's just sort of on occasion, and I haven't found any challenge with that at all. But people, of course, always ask me, if I take enzymes from the outside, is that going to tell my body to shut down its or slow down its production of enzymes?
That's a good point. And, you know, I'm like you, especially when I'm on the road, I've got to make sure I have a bottle of enzymes. I, like other people, tend to overdo it at those nice restaurants. But the bottom line on that answer is no. The mechanism by which the pancreas produces its enzymes is not based on a feedback mechanism for the most part. The pancreas cells are always producing enzymes and the, in an inactive form, and it stores it in the pancreatic duct, again, as inactive enzymes. And then once the hormonal signal, as the stomach acid leaves the stomach and goes into the GI tract, the cells lining the duodenum detect the change in the pH due to the acid, and they produce a hormone that causes the pancreas to shoot out its enzymes into the duodenum and then become active. So, no, you're not going to cause your pancreas to start decreasing production of those enzymes.
Great. I think that's always an important question people want to know about. And then the other one that a lot of my autism clients want to know about is probiotics, because what we've all heard is that the enzymes can help break down the cell wall of candida and yeast that we don't like, and so then the question became, well, can it also break down the cell wall of good beneficial probiotics? And a lot of these kids are taking probiotics at the same time, at the same meal that they're taking the enzymes, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm not exactly how that got started, but again, let's kind of use common sense. Our pancreas produces enzymes. There's digestive enzymes in the gut, just about all sections of the gut, and that's where the probiotic bacteria are. So obviously, probiotic bacteria and our pancreatic enzymes, or our natural endogenous enzymes, coexist quite nicely. There is a difference between yeast cells and bacteria. Bacteria do not have this hard, woody outer coating that yeast cells have, and that's why yeast is so hard to get rid of, because it's very hard for antifungal agents to break down that or get past that hard, woody covering that's primarily cellulose and some protein. But bacteria aren't that way, and bacteria have cellular membranes that are designed to be resistant to proteolytic attack. So, I don't know where that got started, but really we recommend that there is no problem with having proteolytic enzymes, or any other enzyme for that matter, taken along with a probiotic product as well.
Great. And you mentioned briefly in passing medications. So if people are taking medications, is there anything that they should be aware of with enzymes?
Well, again, the enzymes are very specific in what they do. So they're only going to work on proteins, carbohydrates, and triglycerides. And most medications do not fall into those categories.
Mm-hmm.
In the future, there may be, as there is some research going into peptide-delivered or peptide-derived drug delivery. Anyways, but for now, that's not a problem. The only caveat we say, and again, we're not sure on this, but we want to err on the side of conservative thinking here. Some time-release medications that use cellulose as part of the time-release mechanism, you may want to avoid those enzyme products that contain high amounts of the enzyme cellulase. That might cause a problem in the amount of drug delivered. But again, we're not certain that that is a problem, and we're basically setting up a series of experiments with different time-release drugs to verify that if that is actually a problem. But most time-release medications, especially the newer ones, do not use cellulose as part of the time-release mechanism. They may use cellulose as a binding agent, and that's okay. But most drugs use propylene glycol or some other material as part of the time-release mechanism, something that the enzymes don't bother. But if someone has a question, they should call the pharmaceutical manufacturer, ask for their technical support, and just ask them whether or not taking a cellulase enzyme would interfere with the time-release of whatever drug they're concerned about.
Great. And in our last, we have about 5 minutes or so, I wanted to talk about gluten versus gliadin and celiacs, because I know that there's probably some listening right now, and I wanted to clarify who these enzymes will work for.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because we want to make sure that people are not confused about this. We get several calls a week from people who have celiac disease asking if the enzymes will allow them to go off a gluten-free diet. And the answer is always absolutely not. Celiac disease is different from the gluten intolerances that we're talking about. Currently, there is really no good commercially available enzyme to break down or change the structure of gliadin, and that's not the same peptide as glutamorphin. So those are two different peptides. So, however, there is some interesting research. I think it's out of Stanford. A paper came out in 2002 where they did find a bacterial enzyme that seemed to be effective in breaking down gliadin. And again, I want to emphasize that enzyme's not commercially available yet, but what that does mean is that there is a segment of research targeted toward people with celiac disease, and there may be some hope in the future. Also, just recently, there was some interesting news that another type of enzyme may be used to reduce the allergenicity of peanuts and other type of allergens. So again, they're not available yet, but it just shows that the interest in the research community for looking for uses of these enzymes to make food more healthy, basically to reduce the chance of allergic attacks. So I'm looking forward to actually enzymes being a real hotbed of research in the next few years.
Great. Me too. So just to kind of summarize, so for people, whether they have digestive challenges or gut inflammation, or we didn't even necessarily go into all of the different reasons that somebody might need enzymes, but when enzymes are in short supply, very often these IgG immune system reactions will start happening. And so these enzymes can help break down the proteins in these foods, whether it's gluten or casein or eggs, or will it just help to break down all of those kind of fats, carbs, and proteins and help to have less reaction in the gut? Is that basically what's happening?
That's what we believe is happening. Certainly most allergens are from proteins. So proteolytic enzymes, if they're doing their job, and the ones that are available commercially in most enzyme products are what we call broad spectrum. They break down a number of different amino acid or peptide bonds. So they're not going to discriminate too greatly. You know, if they break down gluten and casein, they're going to break down other proteins as well. So, so yes, if someone in general seems to be a reactor to food proteins as far as their immune system, then possibly. And again, it's not going to they're not going to be hurting themselves by trying. Find a good proteolytic enzyme product that may help you or add additional proteolytic enzyme help to break down these proteins and possibly reduce the chances of a protein becoming an allergen.
Great. And just to clarify for everybody out there, we have been interchanging food sensitivity and food intolerance and food allergy, but what we're not speaking about is your food allergy with peanuts and shellfish where you might break out in hives or go into anaphylactic shock. These enzymes are not for that purpose, correct?
Exactly, yes. Anaphylactic reactions are life-threatening. No way do you take a chance with any product, whether it's an enzyme or or supplement or what. We're talking about the generalized intolerances, maybe a rash or a behavior or a GI upset, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But certainly not the airway constricting, hard to breathe type of reaction you see in the anaphylactic reactions.
Correct.
No enzyme is going to help with that.
Correct. Okay. I'm glad we were able to clarify that. So why don't you give your contact information out on your website so people can find more about you?
They can do a search on Houston Enzymes and find us. Our website is HoustonNI.com. And we have a toll-free number, 866-767-8627, I believe. Let me make sure. It's funny, I can't remember my own number. Yeah, 866-757-8627.
Great. Well, Devin, thank you so much for being with us today.
It is my pleasure, Julie.
Take care.
All right, thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you have been listening to KPOO San Francisco. This is Julie Matthews, and we've been talking to Devin Houston about enzymes, and he is amazing, and the company's wonderful. I've been using the enzymes for a long time, and I really love them. If anybody is interested in a consultation for digestion and enzymes, anything that we've been talking about today, I work with them frequently for both children with autistic spectrum disorders, ADHD, as well as adults and the rest of us that have digestive challenges. So you're welcome. Welcome to contact me, and I'm at healthfullivingsf.com. That's HEALTHFULLIVINGSF as in San Francisco, .com. Or you can reach me at 415-437-6807. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon for Reality Sandwich. Thanks so much for listening.
To tell y'all something, a little something like this. You see, I was gonna start singing right there, but you know, I decided that I wanted to badge him a little bit.